This tape is tape one of a recording of an interview with Dr. Delbert H. Meyer at his home on January 20th, 1997 by James G. Trainum. I know that you were born August 28, 1926. Can you tell me something about your parents and your childhood?
Let's see. My parents both had eighth grade educations. I was born on a farm in northeast Iowa. The farm had no running water, no electricity, and we did our farming through most of the years that I was with my parents by horses.
What were your father and mother's names?
My father's name was Henry, and my mother's name was Frida.
Had they always lived in Iowa, or had they moved here from somewhere else?
They had always lived in Iowa.
They must have given you considerable encouragement to proceed with education, since you indicated both of them only went through the eighth grade.
Well, not really. As a matter of fact, when I was going through high school, I didn't intend to do anything but farming. And then when I got out of high school, I was not quite 17 yet, and I wanted to join the Navy. And my parents didn't want me to join the Navy, so they said, why don't you go to college for a year, or before I do that. So that's how I got my start in college, and they did pay for my first year of college, which was, I think the total bill was like $450 for board, room, tuition, and all the fees, and spending money and everything.
You say you went 1 year to college. Did you then go into the Navy?
Yes, then I joined the Navy, spent 2 years in the Navy, and when I got out of the Navy, I still had intended to farm, but by the time I got out, I was one of the last ones to be let out of the Navy, and all the farms were either rented or sold by that time, so I happened to be visiting my sister, who was in the same town that I'd gone to college in. I went up there, and person in charge of being students said, met me in the hall and said, aren't you coming back to college? And I said, well, it's too late to join now, isn't it? It was like the second week in August or something like that. He says, well, not if you've got a place to stay. And I was telling my sister this after I got back, and she said, well, why don't you can stay with us? And so that's how I went back to college. Good. On the GI Bill.
What was it in college that turned your interest from farming to chemistry?
Well, when I went to college, I hadn't really planned on going, and so I, when I decided to go, I went and saw the high school superintendent and asked him, I said, what do you think I could do? He looked at my records and said, well, he said, you know, one of the things you could do is engineering, because I was pretty strong, my math background was strong in high school, and so I had started out in electrical engineering curriculum at Wartburg. And the second year of that, when I got back, I had to take chemistry. And I had never had any chemistry before, and never even thought about it. And I ran up against this course in which Professor Swenson made the course very challenging, and I was really doing badly after the first 6 weeks. And I finally caught up with all the kids that had high school chemistry, and wound up getting an A for the semester. Plus, it seemed like it was interesting, and the way he taught it was to solve problems. And I enjoyed solving problems, and so that's, you know, I talked to him after that first semester and said, do you think I can still get a major in chemistry? And he said, yeah, we'll work it out. So that's how I got into chemistry.
How large was your class?
In high school?
No, in that chemistry class.
I think there actually were two sections, so there were probably 25 to 30 students.
Mm-hmm. So you had the opportunity to have a good bit of interaction with the professor.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to high school in Maynard?
Yes.
And they gave you a good math preparation there.
Yeah, we had a particular teacher who was, I look back on it and I wonder how he did all the things he did, because he was really the band instructor. And he had the junior high band, the senior high band, he taught instruments to something like 70 or 80 students. And then he taught three math classes on top of that. And in our senior year, three of us decided we would like to have something a little more challenging in math than what they had offered, so we went down and talked to the superintendent about getting geometry. And he says, well, we'll set it up as a correspondence course, and then we'll just have Mr. Ellingson give you guidance on it. Well, the word got out, and we wound up with 15 students, so Mr. Ellingson took on another class. And his classes were a lot like his band. They would get noisy up to the point where he thought it was too loud, and then he'd just kind of say something, and they'd quiet back down. But he made learning such a fun experience that I think you just couldn't help but do well. And as a matter of fact, in that course in geometry, nobody got less than a C, and really, everybody really deserved it.
It sounds as though you were unusually fortunate in having inspiring teachers both in high school and at Wartburg College.
Yeah, I would say so. We also had a coach at Maynard who taught history, and of course that was right just during the period when World War II was starting up, and we'd always start with maybe 10 or 15 minutes of discussion of the headlines of the day, and he had a way of taking that and bringing it into his history class and making you think about what history was about and so on. So I think it was just very good. And then our school superintendent taught agriculture class, and I don't know that I learned much about agriculture, but I learned a lot about organization of thinking and that sort of thing. So I really some excellent teachers, even though Maynard was a very small school. I think we had 16 teachers for the whole high school.
So you were in effect committed to a chemistry major after your first course in chemistry, is that correct?
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. And you proceeded on to a major in chemistry. When did you make the decision to go to graduate school?
Well, when I was getting my bachelor's degree, which is in 49, there had been so many the veterans that had gone to school on GI Bill and were graduating about the same time, and had graduated, so a lot of them had graduated a couple of years later. So the field of chemistry was really full in the industries. So there weren't many jobs available, so I decided with the guidance of Professor Swenson that I should go on and get a graduate degree in chemistry. So that's how I made my decision to go into graduate school.
Where did you go to graduate school then?
I went to the University of Iowa, which was a recommendation of Dr. Swenson, who had also gone there, and he knew some of the professors, which I think was of some help to me later on in choosing who I worked for and that sort of thing.
Did you consider any other universities for graduate study, or just centered in on Iowa?
I just centered in on it and went there.
Tell me something about your graduate school experiences.
Well, again, I really had no intention of going on for a doctor's degree. I was just going to get a master's degree and go work. My wife and I had gotten married after I'd gotten a bachelor's degree. She'd gotten her degree then at the same time. And but by the time I was going to get my master's degree, things still hadn't opened up in the job field. And I was talking to my advisor about this, what I could do, and he said, well, why don't you go out and just forget getting a master's and just go out and get your doctor's degree. And I said, well, do you think I've got enough to do that? And he said, well, what are your grades? And I told him, and he said, yeah, I think you do. And so that's how I decided to go right on for getting a PhD right from a bachelor's degree.
When did you begin your doctoral research?
I'm not sure, but I think it was the second semester of my first year.
Okay. With whom did you work?
Well, this was again I had two choices in organic chemistry that Professor Swenson had suggested, I think. One was Dr. Ralph Schreiner, and the other was Stanley Wozniak. And Dr. Schreiner was, he limited how many graduate students he had, so he was filled up with his limit, and so I went to work for Dr. Wozniak then.
What was the area of your research with him?
Well, when I started out, I was going to work on theophylline derivatives, which are central nervous system stimulants. He was had some association with Smith, Klein, and French at that time, and was interested in synthesizing new drug materials. And that's where I started out. And the project I had worked on, a couple of other people had worked on, and it was one of those where you bumped your head against a stone wall. And so that's where I was at the end of my, about first year, I guess, of research.
But you changed the topic then?
Yeah, I went to a seminar one day, and somebody was talking about illids and that kind of chemistry. And Dr. Wozniak said, well, as we went back to our offices, he says, why don't you think about trying to make an amine imid, which is a nitrogen with a positive charge on one nitrogen and a negative charge on the other. And so I went to the literature, and there wasn't really a lot in the literature on it. At least, as a matter of fact, from my searching, I never did find that anybody had ever made a stable amine imid. It's like the tautomer of hydrazine. And so I went to work and tried to synthesize one of those, and that's what I did for my doctoral thesis. And I synthesized one compound and characterized it. That was it. And no one really was able to use that technique to synthesize another analog. In organic chemistry, once you synthesize one, and then those days anyhow, you synthesized a whole family of them. Well, no one was able to do that. And later on, somebody else synthesized another one with a different technique, and finally, the third student found a more general synthetic method, and it grew to a pretty good sized field. And the last I knew, in 1980, I think Dr. Wozniak wrote a review article in which there were 180 papers and patents that had issued on that topic. So I guess you feel kind of neat that you at least opened up another field for other people to explore.
Yes, I'm sure that was interesting and satisfying to have done. Well, once you finished that dissertation and received your doctoral degree, what did you do then?
Well, by the time I was getting ready to look for a position, the industrial field had opened up, and I had opportunities at that time to interview 26 companies, and I narrowed it down to 10, and then I added two more to it. One because the one company had given me a fellowship, and I figured I just had to give them the right to take a look at me and me at them. And then the other one, the interviewer came through, and he made his company sound so outstanding that you felt you just had to go and see whether it was really hot air or whether he really knew what he was talking about. So then I went out and interviewed these 10 companies, and eventually elected to work for Standard Oil of Indiana at that time.
What was it that persuaded you to choose that one among all the others?
Well, they were starting a new, well, I had been in the process of starting a new group in petrochemical research, and I thought that sounded like it would be pretty interesting. And they were more in the Midwest. I had spent one summer working for DuPont while I was at the University of Iowa in their Wilmington research area. And although I very much enjoyed working for DuPont, I didn't care for the Wilmington area at all. And they did make me an offer for Waynesboro, Virginia, but I eventually decided that Standard Oil was the place I wanted to go work for.
So it was a combination of the work that you were going to be associated with and the geographical location that persuaded you that Standard Oil of Indiana was the place for you.
Well, it was at least the work I perceived I was going to be doing. And I thought at that time that I wanted to do more exploratory type research, and I thought that I had that kind of opportunity to work for Standard Oil. And turned out, I later found out I really wasn't prepared to do that kind of totally independent research at that point in my career.
Well, what did you move into then?
Well, I actually did work in exploratory research for the first 2 years I worked for Amoco, or for Standard. And then they had come to an agreement with Scientific Design to look at oxidation technology to make aromatic carboxylic acids with the cobalt, manganese, and bromine catalyzed system. At that point, everything was clouded in secrecy. And they needed more people to work on that project, and they asked me if I would work on that, and I had realized that I wasn't making very much progress working on the projects I had been, so I transferred over to that project probably 1955, I guess it was. So I'd worked about 2 years in what I call probing or exploratory kind of research, and then moved to looking at development kind of research.
Well, apparently it turned out to be a very astute move.
Well, it turned out for a couple of reasons. Again, I think in my career, I look at it, I'm not sure how much native talent I had. I needed a lot of help. And my first supervisor I had at Standard Oil was not the kind of person that I needed to supervise me. And I moved from him to another supervisor who wasn't afraid to tell the story like it was, and he called me in, closed the door, and said, "Oh, this is your last chance." And I had no idea I was in that kind of situation. But then he went on and said, "Now, this is what I want you to do." And so he gave me a lot of guidance, and the real problem was I wasn't very productive, and I hadn't done nearly as many experiments kind of thing as I should. So he just kept throwing me stuff to do, and encouraging me to keep up with it. One day I was getting frustrated because I thought I just had too many things to do, and I looked. So I sat down and counted it up, and I had 10 projects he had me working on at that time. And so I walked into his office and said, "Which 6 of the 10 would you like me to really work on?" And I think the thing that convinced me of was that I'd finally gotten my confidence. And a lot of the stuff I was doing was analytical research, physical chemical research. I had an analytical minor at Iowa when I was there, so that was kind of natural. But the physical chemistry research was my weakest field. And I did quite a bit of physical property measuring, things like vapor pressure, solubility, that kind of thing. And then in the early stages, part of what I was doing was looking at how to separate. We were oxidizing the mixed xylenes and then separating all the acids. And so I spent a lot of time on how to separate them and how to analyze the materials that we were separating and how to get rid of the impurities, that kind of thing.
Did you turn up any previously untried ways of separating the isomers that were obtained from the oxidation?
But not commercially acceptable ways. Isophthalic and terephthalic acid were the two that were the most difficult to separate, because they wound up just about in any solvent you looked at, they would dissolve at about a 12-to-1 ratio. It was a 12-to-1, 8-to-1 ratio, because it was 88-12. And so then you just couldn't separate them. There were a couple of ways you could get them at 96-4 or something like that, but they weren't really clean-cut methods. And we found that, Jim Roblock and I found that you could actually separate them using a pyridine solvent in which the isophthalic was less soluble than the terephthalic in that particular situation, so you could then separate it back and forth. Turns out that I think, and I did do some work on this, but I wasn't the one who discovered it, but one of our engineers found out that the isophthalic acid would grow larger size crystals than terephthalic acid. And you had to crystallize in the right way. You had to nucleate and then grow the crystals fairly carefully. And then if you did that, you could get a 95-96% separation by just separating them on the basis of particle size. And that's how we actually eventually separated diso and terephthalic acid.
How did you separate the particles on particle size? Surely you didn't have to use tweezers as Pasteur did.
No, I used a door clone, which was you put it through and it was separated them on the basis of centrifugal force. And but you had to, the interesting thing that in order to test this, you had to actually have the door clone the same size as a commercial material. And 500 gallons was enough for a 30-second test. So it did work, and it wasn't as good of a commercial process as you would have liked, because to get the best kind of crystal growth, you had to remove some of the impurities by carbon treatment first, and then the nucleation period was longer than you would like for a commercial process. It just took too long, and but eventually we did make a product that was about 96% pure.
Nearly all of the accounts of your research career emphasize your discovery of a particular good way of purifying terephthalic acid. Was this the way that you are famous for doing, or was there a later development?
No, that was certainly the thing that was the most probably commercially significant discovery I made. I also invented the Amicus process eventually to make dimethyl terephthalate. I made that first because that was our entry. That was the only material that was used for polyester at the time, and so I had invented that process. And that was kind of an interesting thing too, because we were having difficulty really developing any kind of technique for making it on the basis of the experimentation we were doing. And we were wondering one day what happened to the catalyst of the system. And we had been doing sealed tube solubility techniques for determining solubility of the various acids in the acetic acid and water and all those mixtures. And my boss said, well, why don't we see if we can use that technique to find out if it was soluble. And we did, and the glass blower told me that these sealed tubes I was using were good for 5,000 pounds. Turned out later I found out they were maybe good for 100. But they did last. 8 out of 9 would withstand the 2,000 pounds or whatever it is we wound up with. And anyhow, once we got looking at that, we said, well, that would be a good technique to study the esterification, because you could get them up to temperature in 2 minutes and then run them for whatever period of time you wanted and cool them off in 2 minutes. So you could actually get kinetic rate studies, whereas in an autoclave that it took you a half an hour to heat it up and a half an hour to cool it down, you just couldn't do that. And so in doing this, I found out that esterification didn't take place if you went through the critical zone. Methanol critical temperature was at 240, and we were trying to run the esterification at 260. And if you went through that too fast, it didn't make enough dimethyl terephthalate to provide a liquid phase, you got no esterification. So that was really the basis of the invention then, that you had to have some DMT in the process to make it. And we could. That's how we actually got into the polyester feedstock business. And then, even in those days, in 1956, it just seemed foolish to go through all that process if we could purify TA directly. And our terephthalic acid that we made by our oxidation process was a lot more pure than that was made by the nitric acid process. The material I got from nitric acid oxidation was a little better than 90% pure. It was aqua colored, and had nitro compounds in it, oxidation intermediates, whereas ours was just mainly oxidation intermediates and a little bit of tannish color to it. And so that gave us hope for maybe we could purify it. Because with the TA, with the DMT, you had to make the ester. You sent the ester to the polymer people, and they polymerized it, got methanol, which was impure. We got the methanol back, had to purify it. So we went through a lot of steps, whereas if we could purify the TA directly by some simple way, that looked like a lot better way to go.
And the pyridine solubility was your way of purifying it?
Well, to start with, no. One of the real problems, of course, with terephthalic acid is that its good property was, which in polyesters, which it has high temperature properties, it gave fibers the ability to have permanent press in natural way, had a high enough melting point so that you wouldn't melt it with an iron and so on. Was also a negative from the standpoint of processing, is that terephthalic acid didn't melt, and it had very low solubilities. At 200 degrees C, it still was only 1% soluble in solvents like water or acetic acid, which we felt we had to be able to use in order to be economical. And so our first experiments were actually done with sodium hydroxide. We had at Amoco the ability to do 10%, what we call 10% time experiments. And so I guess somewhat due to my encouragement, a lot of people were doing 10% time experiments on how to purify terephthalic acid. And one of my colleagues actually found that with treating it with dissolving it in base first, and then treating it with chlorine, which is really hypochlorite, and then carbon treating it, you could make nice looking terephthalic acid.
Exactly what do you mean by 10% experiment that you were talking about?
Well, that meant that we could use 10% of our time, in theory, to do any experiment on anything we wanted to. Was our choice. Now, it was, if you wanted to get credit for that, of course, you wanted to choose something that maybe the company was interested in or would be interested in. I have quite a few 10% experiments that didn't work out very well, and they stayed in the notebook. But I also had a lot of other 10% experiments that did get known by the company. But anyhow, he was able, and Al Hensley was able to purify terephthalic acid, and we had set that we had to have a material that was as pure as DMT, dimethyl terephthalate, and that was 99.97% by cryoscopic purity measurements. And since you couldn't do that you couldn't melt terephthalic acid, you couldn't get purity that way, we analyzed for all the impurities and subtracted from 100 and hoped that we had analyzed for enough to get there. And anyhow, this material that we made by this salt chloride treating process gave us material that was in that range of purity.
And that was satisfactory for direct use in the polymer production?
Well, we thought it was good enough, and so we made 1,000 pounds of material and sent it to our DMT customers. And they looked at it and came back to us and said that it just didn't make high enough molecular weight. Polymer. And so I was talking with my lab guy who had the lab next to mine, and he was a polymer expert. He made the polyethylene terephthalate from the DMT to measure our quality. So he knew how to make polymer from DMT, and I knew how to esterify from my work on making DMT, so I figured out what kind of conditions we need to run to make ester from terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol, and then he would take it over from there. And so for the first experiment, I made the pre-polymer and handed it over to him, and we had decided to really load up the material with the best catalyst we could think of in quite a large amount in order to get the molecular weight up. Well, we went through it, And these were run in glass tubes, and you broke the glass tube, and as a matter of fact, when the polyester cooled off, it just pulled the glass away from the inside of the glass tube you're in. Then you break the tube, then you drill it for a piece of material so that you can measure the molecular weight by intrinsic viscosity. And on that particular sample, we couldn't even drill it. It was so hard. So we never found out what the molecular weight was. So in our second experiment, we backed off to normal catalyst, normal amounts, and we made material that was the same molecular weight as you made from DMT, and then we went out and got a 100% polyester shirt, Dacron shirt. They were pretty awful things because they were slimy and they got gray looking when you wore them, but we thought that at least we got 100% polyester. We'll compare the color of that with the color of the polymer we made. As near as we could tell, it was the same color. So we concluded then that that was indeed a good material for making, that you could indeed make polyester from terephthalic acid. My colleague in this was Paul Mahalson, and on the basis of those two experiments, we got a patent on how to make polyester from TA, and one of the claims that the attorney put in it was that intermediate that I gave to Paul Mahalso. And I'm not certain, but I think just about anybody that makes polyester goes through that intermediate with PTA, goes through that intermediate. So it seems that at least nobody ever sued for infringement of our customers, sued the others for infringement of their processes. And so I think that at least this was enough to muddy the waters enough so that they wouldn't do that. So I think that in addition to proving to ourselves that polyester really could be made this way, it also decreased the possibility that our customers would sue one another for infringement on their processes.
And this process became a major operation for Amoco, didn't it?
Yes, but not right away. We ran that experiment in 1958, and not much really happened for the next 3 years, except for occasional 10% time experiment when somebody got an idea of how they thought they could purify terephthalic acid. And in 1961, actually a couple of customers came back to our marketing people and said they wanted to go into the polyester business big, but they wanted to do it different from DuPont, and they wanted to do it with PTA. And then we were sitting there with that salt process, which, number one, was about equivalent in economics or worse than DMT. And number two is you'd make a whole bunch of salt that you had to get rid of. And the only way of getting rid of the salt was to pour it down a deep well. And even in those days, for environmental reasons, we didn't want to do that. So we set up then a group of three of us to look for a commercial acceptable way of making purified terephthalic acid. And of course, the tendency always is to go with what you know. And we divided up the areas, and one of my colleagues thought the best way would be to just improve our oxidation process, and which was a very good idea. But he also had the responsibility for looking at hydrogen treatment. And I looked at how could you recycle a salt in the hypochlorite carbon treating process. And although there were some ideas on how to do it, none of them really worked very well. They were just, you could do it, but it just didn't. It wasn't amenable very to commercial techniques. And I looked at lots of other kinds of things. And another colleague of mine was working mainly on, we had to make 1.5 million pounds of this salt process for our customers to develop their techniques. And he had the responsibility for that, plus some other approaches.
Well, after I had looked at lots of different approaches and everything was failing and not doing very well, I went to the other colleague in the group and said, how about hydrogen treatment? Would you mind if I looked at that? He says, no, not at all, but he says, it won't work. He says, it won't work because you'll reduce the benzene ring. And that set a requirement on the system then. So I went back and looked at the major impurity we had to get rid of was the aldehyde acid, which was an oxidation intermediate. And the problem with it was that it formed a constant, it formed a solid solution with the terephthalic acid, so you couldn't separate it. So we had to convert it to something else in order to make it separation. And I had always thought that the easiest way to do it was by oxidation, but it in any of either acetic acid or water, you just could not oxidize that aldehyde down. It would oxidize extremely slowly at best, and then it seemed to me it was almost like it was an inorganic, not a catalytic, but a stoichiometric reaction with the material you thought was your catalyst. So when we looked at the materials that were best catalysts for hydrogenation with of aldehydes and not reduced benzene rings, nickel and kieselguhr looked like the best catalyst. So we got some nickel and kieselguhr and set up and ran the first experiment. We got my technician was very good at scrounging equipment, and he got a big rocking autoclave, and we set up and ran the experiment, and it had no cooling in it, so you had to wait overnight for it to cool down. And we opened it up the next morning, and boy, were we disappointed. Everything was green and just didn't look very nice. But he was pretty stubborn, and he says, let's analyze it. So we had some analytical tools to analyze for aldehyde acid. Boy, the aldehyde acid was gone. And there wasn't much cyclohexane products. And he said, well, why don't we get rid of that green stuff, which was the nickel, of course, had dissolved from the kieselguhr. And so we washed it with nitric acid and some acetic acid, cleaned it up. And it was nice and white-colored looking material. So although we had been chemically successful from an industrial standpoint, we actually set another requirement, and that was that the catalyst had to be resistant to the corrosive nature of the terephthalic acid solution, which really was quite corrosive when you got up to the temperatures we were talking about, which is 240 degrees centigrade. At 240 degrees centigrade, you could get a 10% solution, and our economics people thought maybe working with 10% solution would be okay. So the next best catalyst was palladium on carbon, and a lab partner that was next door to me had been working on decarbonylation of aldehyde ester for purifying DMT. And so he had palladium on carbon, and so he loaned me some catalyst and repeated the experiment. Next morning when we opened the reactor, it was crystals, must have been half an inch to an inch long, nice white colored crystals, and we analyzed those, and again the aldehyde was gone and there was very little cyclohexane formed, and the when we measured the color of the terephthalic acid, it was in the right range, and we said, well, that's pretty good. About 3 days later, the head of the research department walked by, and we called him in and said, we've discovered the PTA process. And, we were a little bit joking about it, but actually, 2 months after we ran the first experiment, we decided that was the process we were going with commercially. And we got together with the Amoco Oil engineers, and my friend who had been working on making the 1.5 million pounds by the salt process, they set the design basis for the process, and by June had the commercial process designed, and we went in to the Amoco management and asked for the money for the first plant, and 40 million pound a year plant, and John Swinton said yes. After he asked, could you sell the product, and the marketing guy says, well, if they can make it, I can sell it. And so in 1965, the first commercial plant started. It was 40 million pounds a year. And by 1970, we had 400 million pounds a year capacity. And then during the 70s, it continued to grow extremely. You grew for 10 years at 10%, at 33% a year. So it was just unbelievable growth. It turns out that we gave some benefits to our customers. We sold them the terephthalic acid at the same price they were buying the DMT, which meant they got 17% more for the same amount of money. And an area that we didn't really know about is that the polymerization took about 15-20% less time when you started with the acid than the ester, because you never quite got rid of all the ester groups, so that the reaction between the transesterification reaction was slower than the esterification reaction, so you got just a little bit more. And when you're talking about at the end, when you're finishing off a polymerization, that's a real reduction, and so it made it a lot cheaper than to make the polyester that way.
So from that hydrogen treatment process came the very successful Amoco process for producing purified terephthalic acid.
Yes.
Is that development the one that in your career was largely responsible for your receiving the Perkin Medal?
As a matter of fact, almost entirely, I think. I did some other things that were important too. I think it's important to say that there were some other things that made the PTA process really work well too, is that when we first started, we moved so fast that everything was batch technology. And in 1962, we finally got to the point where we could oxidize terephthalic acid, paraxylene continuously terephthalic acid. So you had the process that we wound up with is you fed paraxylene into a reactor, you separated the terephthalic acid out, you fed it continuously through the PTA reactor and separated it out, so you essentially had this one smooth, continuous process. Except you did have a separation step in the middle. So it was an extremely simple process in the end, and which meant good economics. The other thing that I think is important to point out is that none of the oxidation technology would probably have been successful, at least as successful commercially, if it hadn't been for the rocket science that was going on. The need in the rocket industry for titanium metallurgy was very important, and our oxidation technology required corrosion-resistant materials. And it turned out that although Haskell-IC was fairly good, it developed leaks fairly frequently. As a matter of fact, our Joliet plant got so good they could change out a reactor in 24 hours and have it set up, so you know that we changed out a lot of reactors. Titanium came along and it resisted the corrosion, and it's been very important. We don't have to change out reactors, that kind of thing. The titanium reactors last very, very long time, and so it was in a large respect, I think, due to the development of titanium metallurgy for the rocket science that our technology has been commercially successful. Matter of fact, the first 8 commercial chemical reactors ever made with titanium were made for our oxidation process.
Amoco was not involved in the titanium research itself, was it? They just used it?
Well, I think, I don't know just how much our metallurgists were involved. We certainly set the requirements for what a reactor would have to be, but it was the metallurgy people themselves that eventually developed the technique. They actually put titanium in a stainless steel shell, and in this way they were able to reduce the amount of titanium that was needed, and you also got the strength of the stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
At the temperatures we were operating, titanium might not have been quite strong enough. Okay.